Now move on to our fifth speaker, who is Dr. David Wegman, who is professor and chair of work environment at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He's chair of my department, I'm proud to say. He received his MD and Master of Science degree from Harvard. Dr. Wegman has focused his research on epidemiological studies of occupational respiratory disease, musculoskeletal disorders, and cancer, and has published over 200 articles in the scientific literature. He is a co-editor with Dr. Barry Levy of a well-used textbook called Occupational Health, Recognition and Prevention of Work-Related Disease. David.
Thank you, Ken. I want to turn a little bit now to a somewhat more subtle area. What happens when this money comes into the university that's industry-sponsored? Here's the problem. Scientific research involves the discovery of new knowledge. Industry sponsors environmental and occupational health research in specific primarily to protect its economics interests. So why would a university accept industrial funding if it's to protect economic interests of the industry? Presumably because it can write the rules and provide adequate protection for its investigators. And I think many science investigators in the universities are comforted by the protections offered by the offices of grants and contracts and the contract rules that protect rights to publish. But I want to ask some questions about how good this protection is in a more subtle way. A common feature of environmental and occupational health research contracts is an industrial advisory group, a group that is identified not to be a group with veto power over the product, over the publications, but one that is simply to provide advice and to, particularly around technological issues, and to make certain that all the information that's collected is correctly represents what is truth in the outside industrial settings. And they are to be advisors but not controllers. Well, how does that work? Can these panels work as advisory panels and not influence the research? I want to give you a couple of examples where I think the question has to be answered no. As a young faculty member here at the Harvard School of Public Health, I was funded to investigate a condition that was newly identified in clinical case reports called meat wrapper's asthma. The leading hypothesis in the literature was the source of the asthma was the hot wire cutting instrument that was used to cut plastic wrap in supermarkets that was then used to wrap meat products, thus the name meat wrapper's asthma. And the industry sponsored a research project, which I was awarded to carry out this investigation. And there was this industrial advisory panel that accompanied the research. Now, this panel did not deny the leading hypothesis, and this panel did not force me not to investigate that leading hypothesis. What this panel did do was constantly raise alternative hypotheses of what could be investigated, even to the point of suggesting at one junction that maybe the problem was the bone dust from the meat that was cut and that was then generated in these environments before the food was wrapped. And the problem that we faced as investigators was the difficulty in saying to the science industrial science advisory group, this is not possible. We refuse to do this part of the investigation. We're going to stay focused on our part of the investigation. And so we covered the waterfront. We've dealt with all of their issues, and we also dealt with our own issues. And we came out with some results, which ultimately did lead to some change in the way the industry did the cutting of meat wrap. But the point I'm trying to make about this is that we spent an awful lot of time doing research that had we been asked to set our own priorities and use our own wisdom and our own advisors as to how we would prioritize which to investigate and which to decide not to investigate, we would have done a much different type of research and much more work in the area which we had to, in a sense, cheat on because we were spending time following what I believe were blind alleys, although not impossible, not implausible. Another example occurred to a colleague of mine who was involved in exposure assessment for a study of cancer risk with fiber exposures. And in the course of her research, the contract called for an established methodology to estimate exposures from job histories in a work environment and do an exposure response study to find out whether there was cancer risk associated with these fibers. And in the course of her investigation, she developed a new hypothesis as to how people should potentially come up with a better measure of exposure. And it was something that she hypothesized. She wanted to see if it was tested against the established method, whether it showed any improvement at all. She was willing to accept the possibility that it did not. She has not to date been allowed to use or have that hypothesis used because the industry says that's not what they bought. They bought the established methodology. The advisory panel said they didn't want to follow this investigation. Well, it's true. What the university bought was a research proposal which had an established methodology in it. On the other hand, what is research about? New knowledge and new hypotheses, and this one is another example of a frozen hypothesis. Can industry sponsor research outside the university and have that research be independent? Yes, I'm sure there are some good examples of this, but I have a couple of examples of problems associated with that. Primarily, research serves the economic interests of the private sector. So the research that's going to be funded, particularly private sector research, even if it's independent investigators, is going to be funded to support an economic interest. An example, in a sense, of a positive one of these was given by a colleague who reported that Barry Commoner was approached in the late 1970s when the new plastic bottle manufactured from PET plastic was being introduced into commercial use. Shortly after its introduction, questions were raised about the validity of some toxicology tests that had been done and whether this was really a safe product. And Barry Commoner was approached by the glass bottle manufacturing companies with a very legitimate, economically interesting question. Is this stuff toxic? The reason they wanted to know was if it was toxic, they were darn well going to stay in glass bottle manufacturing. And if it wasn't toxic, they saw the writing on the wall and they were going to move into plastic bottle manufacturing. So they wanted the true answer, and they didn't have a vested interest one way or the other. So in that setting, the research might have been carried out without undue influence from industry. The flap about the toxic test blew over. The agent continued to be used, and many of us are using it today and are sitting up here at the panel, so I hope it's not toxic. The other example I want to go to is an old and tried, almost hackneyed example of benzene. You just heard Phil Landrigan refer to it a moment ago. And the initial studies of occupational cancer and benzene that really put it on the map were the studies that Infanti and colleagues published in 1977 suggesting a very high excess risk of benzene and leukemia risk in workers in an Ohio plant. A consultant to the American Petroleum Institute at one point back in the 70s told me that benzene is a cottage industry. There's more research done around this study than most other topics, let alone most other substances. This particular study was criticized at the time by industry consultants by saying that additional information showed that the estimates of exposure were incorrect, that they were too high, too low, that the exposures really were higher and therefore the dose response was lower. Infanti reported in his response to that he'd asked for that information. Somehow it hadn't been previously available. Now the additional information was available. In 1987, Rinsky updated that report and re-established the risk with essentially the same level of risk. He was now able to show a dose-response relationship that was very nicely modeled. and he had a much more elaborate exposure assessment that was carried out. In 1992, another exposure assessment was done, sponsored by the industry, and my understanding is it cost about $1 million to go back in to get more additional data that was newly found from these same records on this same population. And a new exposure assessment was done, which then was applied to a risk assessment. And I just, perusing Medline today, found that in 1998, the Japanese Society for Occupational Health used that exposure assessment in setting their proposed occupational exposure limit for benzene. So is that bad? Was that last exposure assessment a poorer exposure assessment or a better exposure assessment? I don't know. It certainly had more detailed information in it. But what I'm particularly upset about is that none of this money goes into looking for more detailed exposure information in negative studies. It's only if there's a positive study out there that suddenly there's a massive effort that you go into to try to find new information. So you might have good science being done, but is it unbiased science? I would say no. Well, where do we stand now? Shelley illustrated quite dramatically the increase in industrial funding that's going into the university setting today. Some of you may be puzzled by that. NIH seems to keep getting, you know, $10, $15 billion more every year, so there should be more money out there in the public sector. Well, certainly in the area of occupational and environmental health and toxicology research, not a lot of money is going that way to solve problems in our modern industrial environment. So what can we do to address these problems? First, I think we need to establish some mechanisms to protect the independence of investigators. We have to design mechanisms to protect researcher independence regarding the conduct of the study, the use of the data, and the public dissemination and publication of the data. Stronger protections than currently exist within the university grants and contracts environment. We have to appropriately limit scientific advisory boards regarding their independence from the sponsor or the sponsor's independence from them, their role during the study, their appropriate role, and the role of interpretation and determination of results. And finally, worker rights and notification need to be included so that workers learn about this information, not just from JAMA, as was suggested last night, but by efforts to notify and disseminate the findings to the workforce. Lastly, we need to establish a firewall between the sponsor and the research scientist. And such firewalls are possible. They are used in Europe. Our example, a sad one to my mind, is the Health Effects Institute, because they have a wonderful co-sponsorship of industry and EPA in funding a lot of good research, but they're also subject to the same kind of pressures that industrial funding puts elsewhere. One of my colleagues was funded to study asbestos in commercial buildings, started the study under HEI sponsorship with 50% industry funding, and 6 months into the study, the money was pulled because the industry didn't like who was doing the studies. Thank you.